Good evening, everyone. Please find your seats.
I'm giving a full report to my son-in-law on everything you say tonight.
I'm responsible for any word I say.
Good evening, everyone. I mentioned this morning, immediately after davening this morning, that the Netziv has an amazing comment at the beginning of Sefer Vayikra. The Netziv writes in the second Pasuk, you have this expression that we hear many times in the Chumash, Daber al B'nai Yisrael v'amarta aleihem. The language of that Pasuk seems somewhat redundant. Speak to the Jewish people and say to them. So it must mean two different things. So the Netziv suggests in the context of Moshe Rabbeinu's relationship to Hashem and to the Jewish people, that Daber al B'nai Yisrael refers to the Torah Shebachsah, and v'amarta aleihem refers to Torah Shebalpeh, the written Torah and the oral tradition as well. And he says that Moshe Rabbeinu had two responsibilities. One was to give the Jewish people exactly what Hashem wanted the script of the Torah to be. And the second was to give them a commentary, to give them an explanation of what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was talking about, what the Torah meant. Daber al B'nai Yisrael, you have to teach them the primary text, the Amarta Aleihem, and you have to explain to them what that text means. And he goes on to explain that the language of Amira and the language of an Amora is someone who offers commentary to a primary text, and it's based on the paradigm of Moshe Rabbeinu. So if the Mishnayos become a paradigm, they become a primary text, so then the commentary to it are the Amoraim, because they are the ones who go on to explain it. And think about Rav Soloveitchik's legacy. I think this very much rings true. In a certain sense, Rav Soloveitchik changed the world around him by all the people that he taught, by all the people that he inspired, and the way that he revolutionized the way that American Jewry and world Jewry thinks about Torah. But we weren't just the beneficiaries of Rav Soloveitchik. My generation in particular are the beneficiaries of his students as well. It's not only the Daber al B'nai Yisrael, but it's also the Amarta Aleihem. It's not only what he said, but it's the students that work tirelessly to listen, to record, to publish, to explain, to annotate, to publish again, over and over, the wealth of information that we have from Rav Soloveitchik 25 years later, 25 years after his passing, is very much a credit to our role models, to the generation that came before us that solidified his legacy, hopefully for all of eternity. And I think it's obvious to many people in the room who know Rabbi Rakefet, and it's wonderful to see so many connections in this room. I want to welcome Rabbi Donny Cohen, who's visiting from Stanford, also special for the occasion. And to know that Rabbi Rakefet is one of the people who has done exactly that, devoted a half a century or more to teach slightly more.
59 years.
But who's counting? 59 years of teaching Torah, and specifically the Rav's Torah, and publishing, and helping make sure that the Rav's legacy is alive and well with us 25 years later. So it's not so often that he's here in America, and even less so at the Jewish Center, so it's a particular kavod for us to welcome him in honor of the 25th yahrzeit of the Rav to share Torah with us, and I hope and I'm sure that everyone will enjoy the evening.
First of all, I want to mention that, I don't know if you realize it, in the Jewish Center, but this September, Be'ezrat Hashem, you should make a big party here because it will celebrate 90 years since Yeshiva College opened. Now, would you care to guess where Yeshiva College opened? Right here in this building. Read my first work, which has now gone through four editions, Bernard Revel, Guild of American Jewish Orthodoxy, and you will discover that the campus uptown was not ready, but the students had already registered, the faculty was hired, and it opened in this building. So I'm very pleased to be here. A drop of background, why I'm here, Chtav Sain Gut Mishugah, I gave shiur last Sunday, Monday in the Kollel, summer weather in Jerusalem. You didn't need a sweater by day. And I came on, Malk and I came Tuesday, and not an easy trip the air is the least of it, the flight, getting to the airport, the bitchoniyot, coming from the airport, getting, and then Wednesday I'm giving this major lecture at YU, and I hear Wednesday morning school is closed down. But thank God, David, I still had a little bit of a crowd. And I guess yesterday the Ribbono Shel Olam made it up to me. It was a standing room only. It was a very major crowd and wonderful, wonderful people. Now, why you asked me, Reitz, it's being sponsored by Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchol Hanan. They asked me to speak about the Rav. On principle, I don't repeat a lecture. So if I haven't repeated a lecture since the Kollel began in 1978 with a formal program, I actually have students that have studied with me 40 years plus, this is the sixth lecture I'm giving since I arrived. There'll be another four more. Each one is different, a different aspect of the Rav. Unfortunately, a good deal is given on Shabbos, and since I'm a good Jew, I'm not a Satmar. Satmar solved the problem. The Rebbe was in Israel, he went to Meiron, they hired Russian Goyim living in Israel to video the Rebbe on Shabbos. What they can do, a good Jew cannot do. So I apologize. But the other lectures are on whyutorah.org. Now, what I want to talk about tonight is a question that I've been asked 1,001 times over. You're living in an art scroll world. The art scroll world, I mentioned yesterday that if you come into my office in Yerushalayim, it's like a museum. I charge admission, students are invited free. Anyone who heard a shiur from me comes in chinam in kesef. But on the wall are pictures of Gedolei Yisrael and interesting moments in Torah history. Behind the door, the Gemara in Chelek, pictures of Joe DiMaggio, Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, and that is done on purpose so that students should know the Rebbe was not born with a yarmulke on his head. You understand? It's not art scroll. Life is real. There are challenges. There's development of a human being, etc. Here you have an amazing story. The Rav's family, you talk about Rav Chaim Brisker, the Rav's grandfather, not just opposed to Zionism. Agudat Yisrael, he attended the first organizational meeting in 1912 and he walked out in anger. And it's a fact, it was told to me by Reb Aaron Soloveitchik, it was told to me by Tova. It's a fact. What happened is, it's a beautiful story. It captures Reb Chaim. They cajoled him, Rebbe, again, I break into Yiddish or Hebrew. If anyone doesn't understand me, raise your hand and I'll speak Goyisha language, English. Rebbe, Mindaf Gein, come, you have to. We're organizing, grounded on organizations. Hated it. So Reb Chaim came. And at this original meeting, there were a few Hasidic Rebbeim, Litvish Rashi Yeshiva, and Yekis, Yekish Rabbanim. And Reb Chaim, in the middle of one of the rabbis' talks, walks out and goes home, never returns. So they asked him, what went wrong? And Reb Chaim said, "Ich kenne ein Sprach. I know only one language. Mitaf reden Torah. You have to talk Torah. You have to cite sources. If a rabbi from Germany can speak for a half hour and not cite one Gemara, this organization is not for me." So you see, Reb Chaim, the Zionist, he was altogether opposed. Zionism, Jewish sovereignty in the state of Israel, apikursim. God has to do it, not human beings. Agudat Yisrael, not his cup of tea. Of course, his most brilliant grandson was my Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, to put him into context, 1903 to 1993. And the Rav, I spoke about this Shabbos in Teaneck. The Rav's life, no other giant of Torah was exposed to as many influences as the Rav was. He was born in Pruzhan. Everyone thinks he was born in Brisk. You're generally born in Europe where your maternal grandparents live, not your paternal. Reb Moshe, the son of Reb Chaim, married the daughter of Reb Elia Feinstein, the Prujana Rav. Reb Elia Feinstein was related to Reb Moshe Feinstein two ways over. Reb Elia and Reb Moshe were cousins, but Reb Elia's wife, the Rav's mother, Rebbetzin Pesha, was a first cousin to Reb Moshe Feinstein on her own, nothing to do with the Feinstein name. Their mothers were related. So the Reb Moshe married a girl with a PhD. A PhD means Papa has dough. Reb Elia Feinstein agreed to support Reb Moshe. You know Yiddish, gig essen kest. You've heard that expression. So for 10 years, Reb Moshe sat in his father-in-law's home and learned that's where the Rav was born. So you see, right away in the Rav's early life, there's a dual influence. Reb Chaim, Reb Elia Feinstein. Afterwards, he lives in Chaslovich, Poland. They run away after the communist takeover, Berlin. Along the way, there's a Chabad influence, a Gera influence, a Majid's influence. And then he goes to Germany, 1926 to 1932, very formative years, University of Berlin, getting a doctorate. Now, in the University of in Berlin, he comes in touch with the elegant rabbis of the German Orthodox world, Rabbi Meir Hildesheim for one, Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg of Lithuanian origins, then the head of the Hildesheim Seminary, and he's exposed, Professor Avram Berliner. These were very high-class Talmidei Chachamim, and at the same time, very worldly people with tremendous general knowledge. Many of them were advocates of Agudat Yisrael. Agudat Yisrael, which really starts functioning after World War I in 1919, makes two decisions in 1919, which supposedly should continue until today. They were never abrogated, because if you abrogate them, it's a contradiction ab initio. You'll understand me in a minute. But the two decisions were, number one, anything the rabbis say is infallible. What is it called in popular language? Das Teira. Das Teira. Da'at Torah. Das Teira. All right. That's one decision. I don't want to comment further. I know about infallibility, but I never heard of it in our religion. As a matter of fact, anyone who's studied Shas and Paiskim knows that one of our Masechta deals with what they didn't have to do if they make a mistake. We're humans. We're not angels. The second part of their decision was there can be no Jewish sovereignty in the state of Israel before Messiah comes. Well, it seems to me, having lived in Israel 49 years, I taught Torah 10 years in America and 49 years in Israel, and watched the Agudat Yisrael in action, I think they're very much part of the sovereignty of the state of Israel. And the Eda Haredit, if you read HaChoma, their publication, they never let Agudat Yisrael forget that they've transgressed their own rules and regulations. If the rabbis can't be wrong, then how can you be part of sovereignty? And if you're part of Jewish sovereignty, then you're saying the rabbis can be wrong. This was Agudat Yisrael. This was a real powerful Agudat Yisrael. The head of the Agudat Yisrael was from Frankfurt, Germany, Rabbi Yaakov Rosenheim, and these were real Agudistim with dignity, with a platform, anti-Zionist figure. Good reasons. Many of the Zionist leaders, Mechallelei Shabbos, Ochlin Levedet and Treifat, I don't have to overstate the case. You just mentioned Ben-Gurion, and forget about Ben-Gurion, just mention his wife Paula. So her hatred for Yiddishkeit was unbelievable. I had met two soldiers who once got a lift. There were a few cars in Israel, and Ben-Gurion was going down south, and he was going to his kibbutz. They had to get to Be'er Sheva. And two soldiers come into the car, they take off their kumtot, their army hats, and they have kippah on. They say Paula almost had an epileptic attack that two people are sitting in her car with kippah. Vera Weitzman, Chaim's wife, when she saw a Hasidic Jew enter the Weitzman Institute campus, she was ready to commit hari kari. So, all right, you can understand that good at Yisrael on that level. The Rav, 1932, comes to America. People don't realize, but these are facts, well-researched. The first 10 years of the Rav's life in America, he had one dream, to conquer America as a rabbi. His role model, those of you familiar with my second volume, which also has gone through four editions, the Silva era. Reb Lazar Silva was an unbelievable, colorful figure on the American scene. You've heard the name, Rav in Harrisburg, Springfield, Cincinnati, president of the Agudas HaRabbanim, the famous story which I actually documented. Now, when I talk about his personality in my book, I'm very careful because I have a doctorate in Jewish history. I have to know what you can write. And this story actually happened maybe even more than once. He was on his way to the airport, always in a rush, and the taxi driver is rushing to catch the plane, and the police call him over. And he tells the policeman, officer, I have the chief rabbi of the United States sitting in back, and you hear from the back of the car, chief rabbi of the United States, and you hear, and Canada. That was Reb Lazar. The Rav loved him. There was a kinship between them. Reb Lazar was a Talmud Chochem, a Litvisher. The Rav loved him. 1937, Rabbi Silva now is world famous. He's the last American Rav to become world famous. Today, the Rosh Yeshiva are world famous. The teachers, not so much the rabbis, but Reb Lazar Silva, world famous. 1937, Agudat Yisrael is holding its last Knesia Gadola, the last international convention that it will hold before the Holocaust in Marienbad. And Reb Lazar heads up the American delegation. He goes to see his Rebbe, Reb Chaim Moisey Grzynski, in Vilna before he goes to Marienbad. And Reb Chaim Moisey tells him, I'm quoting word by word now, Lazar, mein teure Talmud, mein Deja, as man darf gründen die Agudas Yisrael in America. My dear student, Reb Lazar, it is my opinion that now the time has come to organize Agudat Yisrael in America. Well, Reb Lazar goes back to America. His Rebbe told him what to do. 1938, already in Cincinnati, down the block from the Center of Reform, Jews are walking with bekishes and strimels. The first convention, Agudat Yisrael, Mori Urebi, Rav Soloveitchik is there. They organize an executive committee. And who is chairman? Mori Urebi, Rav Soloveitchik. They organize a Moetzet Gedolei HaTorah. You should know a kid was lost to Yiddishkeit because of what I'm about to tell you. It's a very sad story. I wish it weren't true. I once mentioned in class that Mori Urebi, Rav Soloveitchik, was a member of the first Moetzet Council of World Torah Sages organized in the United States. Now, I always have outsiders sitting in my class. Sometimes these are outsiders who become regular students, retired professors, rabbanim. I have outsiders who have been with me 20 years, 25 years, etc. But then there are also people who come for a lecture who want to hear a kefet. Fine, anyone is welcome to come. Tourists who come in, we get emails from every country you can imagine. Am I teaching on this and this day? So I tell my secretary, you have to answer. We hope the Rebbe will be teaching, but you know, I have a Brit of a great-grandson. I had three big simchas within 8 days a few weeks ago, so two classes were knocked out. All right. So a kid is in there, a Baal Tshuva, a wild kid. I believe he's from the coast. He's from the a wild kid, a genius. And he hears me say this. He goes back and tells his Rebbe and Osameach what he sat in Rav Rakefet Shir, and Rav Rakefet said, and his Rebbe said, Rakefet is lying to you. It's impossible. And this kid is a smart kid. He goes to the National Library and he looks up Hapardes, which gives you all the rabbinic news, and it's readily available. I think it's online today as well. And he sees chairman of the committee, member of the Secretary, Rav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik. You should know this kid threw away Kol HaTorah Kulo. A Rebbe lied to him. He's online. He has a web genius, anti-religion. I'm not ashamed. I called him, you should know. All right, I got absolutely nowhere. I could have called Meir Tzidung. I might have gotten a little further. But now you have to ask the tremendous question. Soloveitchik, he gave a hesped for Rabbi Chaim Moshe. I don't have time now, but it's you'll ask the leaders of Aguda today, they will tell you the most Aguda-like statement of Torah learning ever made in America was Rav Soloveitchik's hesped for Rabbi Chaim Moshe Grushinsky in 1941. And then we see after World War II, the Rav is a Mizrachist. Wow, this is not art scroll. He was shifting gears, shifting his kippah, shifting his entire outlook. And of course, you have to ask, what happened? What happened here? And I'll tell you what my research turns up, and I'm happy to tell you that I said this many years ago, I can prove it, and Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, a few years later, gave a talk in the Gush, word by word, the conclusion I reached. You see, Agudat Yisrael took the approach that Jews have used throughout the generations, throughout the millennium. There's a special word for it in Hebrew, shtadlanut. Shtadlanut, what does it mean? Don't rock the boat. A little bit graft, a little bit vodka. Keep them happy. Don't rock the boat. The late 30s, my parents always spoke about it, Zichronon Levracha. My parents were born in Harlem. The fact that I know Yiddish has nothing to do with my upbringing. It's a result that in seventh grade in elementary school, I had the Shanghai crowd as teachers. They had just arrived in America. They didn't speak a word of English. And ich hab nicht geredet, a wort in Yiddish, understand? But thank God it worked out. So there was this big, you can check it out historically, there are probably pictures online, the computer is a fabulous instrument, what the computer has, it's beyond comprehension, how much Torah and Yirat Shemayim and what you have there. I don't have time to look at it, but I'm told 1,000 times over, this year, who recorded me? Who tell, God, it's unbelievable. You punch in the Lubavitcher Rebbe, you'll get enough Fabregans to last you for the next 77 years. Fabulous. So there was this big rally at Madison Square Garden against Hitler to boycott Germany. My parents couldn't even get in. The crowd was so big that they were standing outside with another 12,000-13,000 Jews in addition to the 25,000 inside. I think this was 1938. Agudat Yisrael, totally opposed. Rattling the boat. I can assure you the Rav was not there. Well, the war broke out, and all of you know, by 1942, we absolutely knew what Hitler was doing. Roosevelt got the State Department to squelch it. You're all familiar with the Reform leader, Rabbi Weiss. No word publicly, it'll hurt the American war effort. But by 1943, you couldn't hide it. And Jews were dying tens of thousands daily. I remember one of my earliest childhood memories. I remember two things before the war ends. One, I remember the day, December 7th, the war broke out. I can still hear my father yelling to my mother from the living room to the kitchen, and my father was listening to the big radio. Jenny, Jenny, they bombed Pearl Harbor, we're at war. My other memory is on the 3rd Avenue L, holding the New York Post. I was a kid with my father, and I say to my dad, Papa, how can we sit here and eat and laugh and live a normal life if every day tens of thousands of our cousins are being decimated by Hitler? Well, the rabbis organized in 1943. What am I going to say? The March on Washington. 2 days, the Rav broke down in tears and said, Zwei Tag vor Yom Kippur. Und mir darf verstehen, was das meint, sa Rav. Two, I translate, you don't know Yiddish, I gather. I'm sorry. But you have to hear it in Yiddish to appreciate the period, but I'll translate. 2 days before Yom Kippur, 300 rabbis marched on Washington to meet the President of the United States and plead for Jews. This too is online. You can see pictures. The Rebbe was not one of the big shots. He was not even known. He's way in back. But up front, I've identified people. Ask me, there's Rabbi Leventhal and Rabbi Silva and Rabbi Rosenberg, the most famous Rabbanim of that era. And believe it or not, FDR refused to see them. He sent out Henry Wallace to placate them. They gave a cock and bull story. The president is elsewhere. And the Rav said, I quote, and you know how much power the vice president of the United States has. Yeah, you've been through it. There were times they were hunting for the vice president. They didn't even know where he was recently. All right, be it as it may. The Rav said time and again, after World War II, I quote him word by word in my two volumes on the Rav. The Rav, the world of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, the Rav said, I quote word by word, we should add another al-chait. We should add another al-chait on Yom Kippur. Al-chait shechatanu lefanecha sheshamanu kol tzakat achenu be'erapa v'lo asinu dai v'lo asinu maspik. That we heard our brethren crying, pleading, save us, and we didn't act. And that March on Washington was the catalyst that pushed Rebbe into a much more activist position. And once you go into a more activist position, then of course you will become a Mizrachiite. I have to tell you, you all heard of the Boston Rebbe. There's a memoir from the Boston Rebbitzin that was published by the subcompany of Art Scroll, I think it's called Misora, if I'm not mistaken. And it's worth reading the memoir. She too, I footnoted in my work on the Rav, she too says that her husband was decimated by what happened in Washington when the finest, most wonderful, leading rabbis of the Jewish people in the United States and Canada marched to meet the president and he refused to see them. And she said it had a big impact on her husband. I can tell you later in life, the Boston Rebbe said to many of his close confidants, if I had my strength, I would leave Agudat Yisrael and join Mizrahi. He was overwhelmed by what Agudat did to Gush Katif. Some of you may or may not realize the whole exodus from Gush Katif was made possible by Agudat Yisrael. It's an absolute fact. I'm not saying it because I'm a Mizrachiite. This is a fact of history. And the Boston Rebbe was overwhelmed with despair. But older people, it's a little bit hard to take a strong stand when you have health problems, etc. Now, the Rav came to the Mizrachi movement B'lei v'nefesh, heart and soul. One night, 1956, and you know, I'm not a youngster. Some of you here are not youngsters. Chazal already tell us from Pirkei Avot, Ein lecha adam shein lo sha'ah. Everyone has one special moment in his life that changes eternity. 1956, the Rav is the honorary president of the Mizrahi, and the Mizrahi movement starts badgering him. Rebbe, we have to celebrate Yom HaTzmaut, we have to do something nice publicly. We have to do something publicly. And the Rav agreed to give a talk at Yeshiva University, Lamport Auditorium. Two people in this room that I know of were there. One is named Malka Rakefet and one is named Darren Rakefet. They were high school kids. I actually can point this out in the picture of the audience. Place was mobbed. The Rav gave a talk that night in Yiddish. That was the language that the yeshiva was in, the whole atmosphere. Some of you of my students know that I claim Torah came to an end in America in September of 1960 when Danny Greer got the Rav to switch from English, from Yiddish to English. It's the end of Torah. I'm a cliché. But Danny Cohn is a cliché. You follow me, Rabbi Cohn, with all due respect. You're a cliché. Don't forget it. I'm a cliché. So the Rav gave it. And by the way, the manuscript of the talk was in Hebrew. It's very interesting. I only learned this later in life when I became very close to Rebbe's family and the Jewish agency. His notes were in Hebrew. The talk was in Yiddish. That talk, every one of my grandchildren learned that talk. Every one of my great-grandchildren will learn that talk, Be'ezrat Hashem. Every kid who studies in a religious high school, in a chesed yeshiva, in a ulpana, wherever you are, that talk, no one has moved the people more than that night. What Rebbe did, he created an entire world of religious Zionism, and willy-nilly, that's a word he taught me in English, that I can't translate because I don't know what it means, I only know how to use it. Willy-nilly, he created a world of aliyah. Unbelievable. What talk am I referring to? Kol Dodi Dofek. And it subsequently was translated, published in Hebrew. I don't believe it was ever published in Yiddish. Maybe Professor Fishman published it now at the seminary. He's a professor of Yiddish, a wonderful individual, and he has published talks of the Rav in Yiddish. Could be he published it in Yiddish. I don't know. I don't know if there's a manuscript. How do you do it in Yiddish? You would need a tape, because the manuscript is Hebrew. There are two English translations have been published, a French translation, and my wife and myself are responsible for the Russian translation, published by Shvut Ami, and we had to edit one part of the talk, because if the KGB would catch it, with, you know, with Amalek, who Amalek is, and the Rav holds anyone who hates Jews is Amalek, whoever would have that manuscript, that publication in Russia, KGB, before 1989, 1990, he'd be in Siberia overnight. We had to edit it, fine-tune that sentence. We worked on it, not to change the Rav's thought, but somehow not to be so sharp. What's the talk based upon? And I'm going to summarize very briefly. Many of you have studied it, but the heart of the talk, the most important part of the talk, it's based upon Shir HaShirim. What is Shir HaShirim about? Shir HaShirim is essentially a love story between God and the Jewish people. And take it now on its most elementary level. To Shulamit, this wonderful young girl, has gone to sleep. She's tired. And her boyfriend, the Dod, comes knocking, wants to see her. He's in love with her. And she says, look, I'm tired. Pashantati et kuntatai, eicha al bishena. I took off my clothes. I'm wearing a slip. I'm in pajamas. Come back tomorrow morning. And tomorrow morning he's gone. And she realizes what a mistake she made. And she goes hunting for him. and she will only find them by Yamot HaMashiach. And of course, it's a message about the Jew and our relationship to God, and we come out of Egypt, and we have the Torah, and we go and worship idols. And subsequently, we're trying to find God, and we'll never achieve the total reunion until the Messianic age. But there's a lot of common sense here as well. You have to understand Shiashirim on many levels. When opportunity knocks, don't let it get away. I've seen so many lives. I've had so many students. Someone's knocking at your door. I'm too tired. Tomorrow's another day. Don't make that mistake. Open the door. And the Rav said, Kol dodi dofek. God is knocking at our door. And he went on to give six major knocks. State of Israel. Until then, Dam Yehudi was Hefker. Anyone could kill a Jew and get away with it. The pogroms, etc. Hitler. And today, we have the most powerful per capita army in the world, Tzva Haganah Yisrael, overwhelmed by that. The Rav went on, no one could come into Israel. The white paper, Al Jolson, I have no place to go. Remember singing World War after World War II. And today, the State of Israel, any Jew has a place to turn to where he will be accepted with open arms. The Rav spoke about Christian theology being debunked. Till now, the Jews didn't accept Jesus. God is punishing them. They lost their land. They lost Jerusalem. And here we are, back in Eretz Yisrael. And the Rav went on and on, Kol dodi dofek. Wake up and answer the call. It's a magnificent talk. It turned into a fabulous essay. No one in post-World War II, if we speak of Rav Kook, Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, as the high priest of religious Zionism before World War II, after World War II, it is this essay. And here I have to share with you one of the finest moments in my life. Should all ask a simple question. Rebbe, you're the greatest Zionist alive. Why didn't you go in Aliyah? I'll tell you more than that. If I would have asked the Rav, Rebbe, should I go in Aliyah? The answer would have been a resounding no. He held like the Lubavitcher Rebbe. We who grew up here know the mentality and can succeed. One of the finest compliments I got in my life when I was already Rosh Yeshiva, was appointed to the faculty in 62. I was giving shirim in the yeshiva. My closest relationship is with the students that I taught from 62 to 69. They're world famous today. There were hundreds and hundreds of people there. I can't count. The yeshiva has no seichel. There weren't enough chairs. They should have gone into Lamport and doesn't matter. Okay. Among them was slew of endless students from the 60s. So one time I'm riding in the elevator with the Rav, and Rebbe says to me, "Oh, I hear nice things about you. You know how to excite the boys when you teach a Taisfus. And believe me, if you know what goes on, how do you get 14, 15-year-old kids excited to learn Gemara, Rashi, Taisfus, Rambam? How do you get it to speak to them? What? Do you want to go in Aliyah and leave us here?" See, it's an interesting viewpoint. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Green of Hamilton, went to the Rebbe, 67, "Rebbe, I want a bracha, I'm going Aliyah." The Rebbe told, "Absolutely not, forbidden for you to go." And he remained in Hamilton. Already has children living in Israel. When I went to the Rav, I didn't go to ask him. I'm not a chassid, I'm a Talmud, I'm a Litvish Talmud. I wrote him a letter, "Rebbe, I'm going in Aliyah, I want to say goodbye to you." And I was already giving shirim in the yeshiva, I was in the rabbinate, but I said, "I'm going to stay later so I can come to your apartment to say goodbye to you." And the first question the Rav asked me was, how will you make a living? And it's now 49 years later, and I still haven't answered that question. But Baruch Hashem, when I met him again, person to person, I cannot say in public what he told me. We'll leave it for another time. But it was not, how will you make a living? So let me tell you something. This is a beautiful story. When I published my two volumes on the Rav, and that was after 22 years of lectures on the Rav and the Kollel, the two volumes are based upon three lectures out of 22 years, but Baruch Hashem. So even though I had stopped teaching Israelis, I had left Michalar in 85, but in the Yeshiva Chesder, people knew about it. I mean, you take Alon Shvut, Rabbi Lichtenstein, a lot of Anglos. So the volumes were on the shelf. A Rebbetzin, wonderful lady, Miriam Shilo, Zichronot Tzadeket Levracha, these are the finest Jews in the world. Her husband was the Rav of in the Shomron of Kedumim, I believe he was the Rav. And this was his wife. She taught in a Ulpana. She may have been principal. She died young. And she was quite ill at the time. And the family went through her letters. And lo and behold, they found an unbelievable letter. And they sent it on to me. And I publicized it today. It's all over the world. What was the letter? Right after the Six-Day War, there was this tremendous spirit in Israel. At any moment, the Gula Shlema will be here. And her students in Ulpana, who had studied Kol Dodi Dofek with her, asked her, well, why doesn't Rabbi Soloveitchik come in Aliyah? Do you know, she wrote to the Rav asking him why. And the Rav, right after his wife died, a magnificent, magnificent, this is the Xerox of the Rav's letter. It's two pages. You can barely read his handwriting, but over the years, I've become a bit of an expert. The Rav was a genius, and he wrote left-handed, so it tells you right away. And I finally deciphered the entire letter, and our secretary in Gris typed it out. And this letter has been translated into English as well today. It appears in the volume put out of the Rav's collective letters by the Torah Tarav Foundation. So in this letter, it's overwhelming. Where you see the Rav, and here you, it doesn't take much to analyze, you have to be a great psychologist. My dear friends, there are people who marry once and marry twice, they can marry three times, marriage never means anything to them. There are people who marry and they merge into one person. With the death of his wife, the Rav ceased to function totally. It's not what he used to be. The total picture was not there. Take the Lubavitcher Rebbe, you have a similar story. And he writes here to this lady, he says, you're absolutely right. I have not been loyal to Eretz Yisrael. And he says, but what do you want out of me? My heart is broken. My dear wife, Motrayati HaChabiba, Bat Einai, Chemdat Nafshi, the apple of my eye, the love of my soul. He says, if she would be alive, we would seriously consider Aliyah. This explains to you Gris and the promise to Mr. Gris that he made. Tova told me many times, if my mother was alive, my parents would have come at least for half a year at the start, and then permanently. Mr. Gris built the campus for the Rav to teach Torah. And what a magnificent letter. And then she evidently wrote to the Rav, who am I to write to you? You're the Gadol Hadar. I'm a simple teacher in an upana. And the Rav writes back to her, Ein gevirti, the Rav's command of Hebrew, Ein gevirti tzrichalitz tadek al dvarecha, gamani Yehudi pashut. And he goes on, he says, you don't have to apologize. I'm also a simple Jew. But we simple Jews are doing the most important activity for the survival of the Jewish people. You're teaching in Givat Washington, that's next to Kerem Biafna, and I'm teaching in New York. We're engaged in the same activity. And I read that there's an undertone there that I'm teaching at Yeshiva University, I'm successful. We who are teaching Torah can't go on Aliyah so quickly. It's the masses of the Jews who are engaged in medicine and lawyers and accountants and business and architects and what have you, but the teachers of Torah, I'm reading it into the letter, but I have a feeling I'm right. We have to be the last, not the first. But what a beautiful, heart-rending letter, displaying above all for this generation. I was just Masada Kedushin yesterday for the first time in my life for a Garush and a Grusha, a Talmud of mine, divorced, his fiancée divorced. I spoke under the chuppah on Matzah and Mora, if you understand what I'm saying. But I did it Pesagi Naha. I did it Pesagi Naha. Carefully, the rabbi who followed me, who's my Talmud's rabbi from Hollywood, from Florida, boy, heap them over the head loud and clear. No cover whatsoever. No veil on his words. But what love for the Rebbetzin and the love for Eretz Yisrael. And this leads me to one more point. And I think you'll understand Moriah Rebbe a lot better. Yes, there was a major difference between him and Rav Avram Yitzchak, a Kohen Cook. I had a connection to Rav Cook that, Vivian, you will appreciate. We had a neighbor in the building, Rav Yoshua Hutner. Rav Yoshua's sister was married to Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook. So I got to know the Cook thinking and family very clearly, living where I've lived for the last 49 years, B'tochechei Yerushalayim. And I'll put it to you very simply, Hegelian dialectics, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. Rav Cook was a Zionist lachatchila. It's a thesis. He didn't need any ands, ifs, buts, proofs. They tell a story when he was going in Ali, when his father-in-law, the Aderet, Eliyahu David Rabinowitz to Omim, was going in Aliyah. He had been the Rav of Panovich. It's related to Rabbi Teitz, if you've recognized the name. It's the Teitz family. When he was going in Aliyah, making a farewell party, and Rav Cook, his son-in-law, got up to speak, and whenever he mentioned Yerushalayim, he broke down and cried. That's a Zionist. Couldn't wait till he could go on Aliyah. The Rav, it's not a thesis. The thesis is Agudat Yisrael. The antithesis or the antithesis is all that happened in the Holocaust. So, of course, we wind up with a synthesis which is not going to be as powerful as Rav Cook's Zionism. And that's the way you can understand the difference between them. Rav Cook, much more right-wing, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, I would say the founder of religious Zionism today, which is much more open and advocate of the land, totality, Shleimut HaAretz, Yerushalayim, and all that goes with it. The Rav, on the other hand, and reflected to a certain degree by Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, much more conservative with a small c. And you have to understand where they're coming from. But I want to summarize. The Rav's life, the story, it's very inspiring. A man was able to shift gears, change position, change his family's attitude, break with his own cousin, Reb Moshe Feinstein, stand proudly in the Mizrahi camp. His publications, Kol Dodi Dofek, Chamesh Drashot, you know what the Chamesh Drashot were? These were sermons, talks that the Rav gave at the Mizrahi conventions. As a matter of fact, the night that Malka and I got married, Rebbe said to me, "Your chuppah has to be on time. I'm finishing. I get the hint. No, have time. Your chuppah has to be on time." I said, "Rebbe, I'm going to do my best." We called the wedding for, I think, 6:30. Chuppah will be on time. But why is the Rav in such a rush? Why is Rebbe? We never refer to Mr. Rav. Why is Rebbe in such a rush? And he told me, "Don't you know it's the Mizrahi convention in Long Beach, and someone is picking me up from Riverside Plaza and taking me to Long Beach, and that's one of the Chamesh Drashot we're given the night of my wedding." And these were very, very powerful religious Zionist drushes. It was totally different than anything you would hear at an Aguda convention. Now, this was his life, this was his position. Look at the heritage he leaves. Most of his grandchildren live in Israel. Reb Aaron Lichtenstein, his influence in Israel is overwhelming. You don't realize it. All the heads of the yeshiva today are on a much higher level because of Reb Aaron at the Gush. Reb Aaron did not compromise with the level that a Talmud can achieve in Shas and Paiskim and understanding a Rambam. Yes, the young men are busy. I have many, many, many grandchildren who did Hezda. And I have to tell you, a kid in Israel has no time. And yet they're the happiest kids in the world. And every survey shows we live longer than the Americans. It's an amazing thing. And the kid has no time to be a kid. I see I have my eldest great-grandson is 8 years old already, Kanayin Hara. He's already worried about his bar mitzvah. All right, then it'll be his bar mitzvah. He says, Sabu, I hope it'll be Ivrit. Wish it was after my bar mitzvah already. Malk and I both walked out. We said, yeah, and then after his bar mitzvah, we saw our own grandchildren grow up, all they're concerned with how they would do the army, what they will do in the army, which division of the army. These kids have, but they raised the level for Reb Aaron Lichtenstein. Because of Reb Aaron Lichtenstein, a new word was coined in modern Hebrew. When Reb Aaron died, I read Hebrew like I read English, but boy, do I get stuck on certain words in Hebrew. I'm looking in Yediyot, I'm looking. Lamrod shehu haya outsider, who hishpia al kol hamedina, even though he was an outsider. Welcome to the Hebrew language, outsider. 1969, I'm reading Mariv, and I have to knock on my next-door neighbor, Devon, and I say to him, "Elitzur, what is this word?" He says, "Ma, talo korei anglit?" I'm looking at him. Golda mevakeshet credit meyatzot abrit. I don't know. I grew up. Ashray is credit. Golda mevakeshet credit meyatzot abrit. So I have to tell you, the Lichtenstein family is the Rav's family. You'll say to me, one son, grandson of the Rav, rebels back in America, Yitzi. all right, people have freedom of choice. Every generation rebels. As long as you stay within the halacha contents, enjoy the rebellion. But I'll tell you what's happened to Yitzi. My students show me a picture of his son in basic training in Golani. But that's the least. Baruch Hashem, he came back. He's in Golani. That's fine. That's good. I take a look. His tzitzits are sticking out. Fine. Good. Tchelet. Oh my gosh, an anical of the Rav. The Rav yelled and shouted, we don't have a Kabbalah, we don't have a tradition. And here, Baruch Hashem, the Tversky family, Lo Aleinu, God have mercy. I spoke about this in class. I just gave some lectures on Yosef Elio Henkin. Who would ever dream? I remember the Rav in the 1950s, his first grandson born, Moshe. Oh, was he happy, and who would ever dream someone will say to you that Moshe will be killed by Arab terrorists in the heart of Jerusalem. The massacre, Har Nof, what was it, 3 years ago already, I have a daughter living right nearby. Oh, God have mercy. Majority living there. But then, take his students. Look how bereft Yeshiva University is, that for the 25th Yard side of the Rav, they have to bring a couple over from Israel to speak, give all these lectures. Rabbeinu Shalom, wherever you turn in Israel, Talmidim of the Rav. You take the Grist building, look at that campus that was built for him. All right, I will admit, it's a good achievement. That building, Mr. Gris was mad at the Rav. He's not coming in Aliyah. He's not keeping his word. Built this magnificent campus. I was teaching at BMT. I get a call from the Torah Culture Department, Cholomei Pesach, 1976. I just finished basic training. It's after the Yom Kippur War. They took every living male who walked upright. Was 38 years old, basic training, Chayil Mitztayein, two awards for sharp shooting. I never had more fun in my life than basic training, but that's a different story. And they plead with me, come to the King David to meet Mr. Gruss. Maybe you can save the situation. He's about to, Teddy Kolak is driving him crazy. You can't leave the building stand empty anymore. It's a security risk. And Kolek wants the building for David Yellen's Teachers College in Beit HaKerem. Well, Teachers College with men, women, Arabs, Jews, etc. And Mr. Gris is about to give it away. Bring your book on Bernard Revel, and the Jewish agency told me we will pay you back. As I said yesterday, I have not been paid back that $6, but it's the best investment I ever made in my life. And there I meet, by the way, the whole conversation between myself and Mr. Gris, you'd have to believe one word I'm saying, because I tell you to check with whom to check that Rakefet is telling the truth. Important, Adam Kareba Eitzel Atzmo. It's my seventh book, Washington, from Washington Avenue to Washington Street. The conversation is there word by word. Vayiftach Hashem et pi haton. God opened the mouth of the donkey. And here I am, and I can show you in the lobby of the King David exactly where we were standing. And I come in, and there's a person there from the Jewish agency with Mr. Gris, and they jump forward to greet me. And Mr. Gris says, I've heard very nice things about you from Mr. Krona. It was Moshe Krona, Mr. Krona Livracha. And I say, Mr. Gris, whatever you heard nice about me, the thank you is to you. So this multi-billionaire looks at me, what the hell is this dummy talking about? I say, Mr. Grist, didn't you give the first $1 million donation ever to the yeshiva in 67? Yes. Who did you give the money to? Didn't you put a pin in it for the Rashi yeshiva? Mr. Grist, overnight my salary was doubled. My wife and I used the money to visit Israel for the first time, RCA tour, 1968. And we vowed we will settle within the year. We came back 10 months later with our little children, Olim Chadashim. we are here because of you. All right, now I have him shaking a little. And then I say to him, I know, Mr. Gris, you're angry at the Rav. But really, what is Torah about? Continuity. Really, does it matter if we can't have the Rav teach here? We'll have his students teaching here. And the voice will be the voice of the Rav's Torah, his understanding of life, continuing his traditions in Israeli context. And with that, yours truly and Mr. Gris cried on each other's shoulders, broke down, cried. The next day he signed the building away to a committee, a trustee. First BMT used it, then the Kollel came in. Ultimately, the trustees gave it to Yeshiva University. And in that building, who's teaching today? The Kollel is small, whatever the reasons are. Rabbi Berman, your rabbi, our next president, our new president, my student, Rabbi Dr. Ari Berman, I have to give covet to him. He studied in Gris, but Gris was... Rabbi Danny Cohn studied in Gris. His father studied with me in Gris. All right, David Deitcher used to sneak into my classes in Gris. Fine. We only fill up one classroom. The whole Kollel, when our best days, 30 students, 35 today, 25. Yeshiva, limited money. You don't want to invest, Gris, etc. We rent the building out to Torah Shraga. You know who runs the building? It is a Bronx mafia. All Talmidim of the Rav. Aaron Rakefet, Bronx, Talmud of the Rav. Rabbi David Miller, the Dean of the Kollel, Bronx, Talmud of the Rav. Rabbi Avishai David, I was at his Brit Miller in the Bronx, Talmud of the Rav. And you can go on and on all over Israel. So I have to say, in retrospect, what a heritage, what a family, what a contribution. And we sit here, we are eyewitnesses. The Brisker tradition came to America, and from America, look at the unbelievable influence on the state of Israel. Rebbe, we thank you for leading the way from Agudat Yisrael to religious Zionism. Thank you very much for your kind attendance. Are there any questions? Rabbi?
Can you do me a favor?
Yeah.
Elitzu and Chana Divon are my first cousins.
Wow, wow.
My name is David, so if you think of it, if you could give my regards.
Write down on a piece of paper.
I don't have a pen or a paper.
One second. I'll give you, ask.